Okay, welcome committee members, members of the public. Today is April 23rd, 2015, and this is the Senate Committee on Human Services and Early Childhood. And for those of you who expected this to be workforce because I'm chairing it, today is an exceptional day because our chair, who really wanted to be here today, Sarah Gelzer, took ill, and she had to go back to Corvallis. And our vice chair, Alan Olson, is doing some family leave for a family member to take care of her. And so I am going to chair this meeting today. And it's a real pleasure for me because I see all the students from REAP that I was just talking to a few moments ago. And it's great to have you all here for this hearing. We have two items on the agenda today. One is an informational meeting on the impact of childhood trauma and discrimination on lifelong health, achievement, and independence. That's a mouthful. And the other is a public hearing on a bill dealing with services to runaway and homeless youth and their families. And what I'd like to do is have the public hearing first and start with that issue. So I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2232. Cheyenne, would you tell us what this bill does?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2232A requires the Department of Human Services to appoint an advisory committee on the coordination of statewide services for homeless and unaccompanied youth. It specifies the committee's role, the composition, and requires DHS to submit an annual report to the legislature by September 15th. Declares an emergency effective on passage. This measure is a second chamber bill, obviously a House bill. It has no revenue impact, minimal fiscal. Came out of the House committee and off the House floor, both unanimously.
Great. Okay. Thank you, Sharon. So with that, I'd like to call up Janet Ahrens and Mike Barker. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, type it next time, Janet. Sorry. Welcome. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator and committee members. My name is Janet Ahrens. I'm the Executive Director for the Oregon Alliance of Children's Programs. We're a statewide nonprofit association of other nonprofits who take care of kids. And that's about $223 million worth of services for children and families and over 100,000 children that we represent. Among our members, you should have received a packet on OLIS, and we also provided a paper one for you just in case because I was a little bit late. But we represent 10 different runaway and homeless providers, and here's their logos. And also attached in your packet are letters from two of those individuals who have services in your districts. So where are these kids? I'm sure that your answer is they're everywhere. But we wanted you to know exactly where they are in your districts, and so we provided you with this document as well. We took the Department of Education's count of homeless students attending school and of unaccompanied youth who are attending school, and we're able to extrapolate by crossing over the school districts in your districts, and you can see your name here and the number of homeless kids and the number of unaccompanied homeless youth. It totals about 1,425 kids just in the five committee member districts here in this. We know from other Oregon data that you have to double the number of kids who are unaccompanied minors and are homeless because half of them are unable to attend school. They can't get to school for a number of reasons. So we're really talking about 3,000 kids, homeless, unaccompanied minors, just among your districts. The so unaccompanied minors was the original intended focus of the runaway homeless system when it was first established. The Alliance has committed itself to this population, these kids, and we were able to move legislation to get the system pilots started and to continue to add funding to the system. We're up to $1.8 million, which, of course, is not near enough if you consider that we have about $900 million going to about 8,000 children in foster care on any given day, and Oregon spending $1.8 million on 19,000 homeless children. So we're hoping to establish the system and have further conversations with you about how we're going to fund these children. But for today, we simply want to have the Department of Human Services Child Welfare Division dedicate an advisory committee to building that statewide system, what it looks like, what the components are, the populations we're going to serve, and what kinds of outcomes we're going to get. The unaccompanied minors focus is important because they're the population who are the most likely to become crime victims. They're the most likely to be sex trafficked. They're also the most likely to be reunified with their families, particularly if you can determine that the families will be safe with services offered and taken. I'm pleased to hear that some of the focus of the informational hearing following us is going to be on trauma. The Alliance did a study of 800 of our statistically sound study of about 800 of our children in our 100,000 child representation, and determined that ACE scores for a number of different carved out or a number of different identified populations, and for 59% of all of the runaway homeless youth, they average a score of 4 or higher. So probably are already well versed in ACEs, and we've given you this document, of course, which breaks out and shows you what the issues are when you have those scores of 4 or more and what the population scores are. So what's happening to these children is that they've got severe family conflict. They've got parents with drug and alcohol or mental health issues. There are significant percentages of them who have been abused or neglected, and 1 in 4 of them have been sexually abused. So these are kids who really, really need our help and who are resilient, and with our services will be able to get us to the outcomes we want, which is simply to finish high school, to be ready to go to work, to get a job, to buy a car from Dick with Nell. And that would achieve all of our goals. So in the past, as I said, the Alliance has moved 5 different pieces of legislation to support and develop this system. We've brought together 3 different groups, large groups, and conducted 3 different studies to look at this population. And we're really, really ready to work in collaboration with the state on system development and a strategic plan that we can bring back to you in the future. So that's the long and the short of it. And Mike has a few more comments and information to share.
Okay, why don't we hear from you, Ms. Balter, and then I know I have some questions, but great. Go ahead.
My name is Mike Balter. I'm the President Emeritus of Boys and Girls Aid, Chair Dumbrough and committee members. Boys and Girls Aid has been serving children, homeless and runaway youth for 130 years in Oregon. And for the last 4 decades, we focused most of our attention in Washington County. Over that time, we've approached the legislature and different departments that have been responsible for these young people, mainly asking for more resources, to be quite frank. The ultimate dilemma has always been, well, what's the plan? How many are there? What are the results you're getting? So we've now focused more on this notion of creating the systemic plan, having the resource allocations straight to the what are they buying, what are the results of what they're buying. I quite frankly, my testimony, the rest of it's just the look at the statute about all the things that are already in statute about advisory groups and plans and things like that. And I think this is actually in some ways a pathetic bill, and that we're asking you for an advisory group and a plan. But that has been a stumbling block. And what we've done, the Alliance, I'm the chair of the Alliance Affinity Group, is that we've said, okay, if we can't move a larger institution or DHS or someone else to develop this plan, let's at least develop it among the 10 programs that represent services in most of the major counties down I-5 corridor and along I-84, where the most of these young people are circulating in large numbers. So what we've attached, and we hope will be useful as an example, you'll see an example like this, which starts with the national statistics, brings it down to state statistics, reaffirms Janet's 3,000 number that we would say statewide are 6,000 unaccompanied minors. And we've tried to use numbers that you're already familiar with. These are McKinney-Vento numbers. These are not numbers that we dreamed up. These are the school counts by every school. We've just then looked at unaccompanied minors and extrapolated. The other thing you'll see here is return on investment. There's been a number of good research studies that the lowest return on investment for serving homeless and vulnerable youth is $4 saved for every dollar invested. At the high end, it's 7. And we can, again, share that research with you. On the other side, you say, okay, well, what are the service components, the most critical service components? Again, rather than making these up, because, you know, service providers will go around and around for 3 years talking about two words. So we finally said, let's just adopt the federal standards. The feds have been doing this. Family Youth Service Bureau has been doing this for about 35 years. They've worked very hard with a large national group of providers to come up with some pretty standard definitions of street outreach, shelter, and transitional living. They also have measurement data about what's an effective service and what are expected outcomes. So we just took those outcomes. We asked ourselves, the 10 providers, to say, start collecting data on a regular basis, report these quarterly to the Alliance, and let's start accumulating those. So that's the result of the first year of data collection. And you can see we've gotten some very good results. Again, 62% of the kids that come into a shelter wind up getting reunified with their family. Without shelter intervention and that intervention, those kids are going to wind up in the transitional living program. It's just inevitable. You know, kids can't raise themselves. They need an adult. The other element you'll see weaved through here is the notion that all the services want to make sure that when young people exit, they have a connection to a caring adult, someone they can count on. That doesn't need to be a biological parent. It could be another relative. It could be a coach that says, I'll commit for the next 5 years to see this young person gets to 25. We're starting to develop those types of contracts with older adults, older youth, and other significant adults in their families or in their life's experience. So hopefully it gives you a good summary of what the system looks like today, just on the 10 folks, 10 agencies that we provide services to. The other thing is, well, what would you buy next? You know, so there's a chart that looks like this. And we use the regions that DHS used in their last, and this should be in the, they should all, this should be stapled in a packet. So if you got the orange one.
It must be on all this.
It's all on all.
Yeah, so if, but you've got this one, you've got the rest of them. So we just took the regions that DHS had developed in their last RFP, and we said, okay, members, sort yourself by these regions. Just what would it take to stabilize, not to grow any new services, but just to keep what you have, because the funding is so unstable. And we came up with about $3 million. So we've been meeting with Ways and Means members, and if we you haven't been met with yet, Senator Moniz, you will be. because this is not about the money at this hearing. Oh, there. I'm showing you things that you can't see. But we're thinking that about $6 million, which would, on top of the $1.8 million, would give us at least a sustainable base for a statewide beginning system by these regions. Okay, it would not solve the problem, but it would begin to create that core, which then the last chart here is, again, we took each of the programs and asked them to say, how much money are you generating with the money that you receive either from the state or the federal government? So you see the power of attracting county funds, city funds, charitable obligations. So we've really got about a $7 million investment. And right now, that's a year. And that's built off about a $900,000 state investment and probably a $3 to $4 million federal investment. So the feds are really the heavy investors here. And I think, you know, our old statement used to be if the state could just match the federal government, we'd actually be in really much further along. So we believe that the state, DHS, who's now the agency in charge or responsible for these youth can develop materials very similar to this, which make it much stronger for all of us to approach you in terms of an orderly way of looking for both service stability and expansion and resources. So we're hoping this is the type of material that DHS will come back with of the plan.
Thank you very much. Thank you, both of you. Questions, colleagues? Yes, Senator?
As you know, I live in Gresham, and when you take a look at the statistics, my district has three times more homeless than any other district that's listed there, even greater. And I have known for a long time and have been fighting for services, just basic services, and we're starting to get them. But talking with the administrators at the schools, it is a huge issue. And I don't think there is just one answer that can help each student. I liked what you said about they need someone that cares about them, that can help them through the struggles or things that they're doing. But that includes charter schools. That includes Boys and Girls Clubs. That includes all these different kinds of services for them. But we've never had the information, at least to me, presented like this before, and it's powerful. So I want to thank you for that and feel that we really, I know it's almost, pathetic what we can do, but we have to start putting our heart and soul into trying to help our kids. So I thank you for bringing this forward. No questions, really.
Okay, thank you, Senator. I'll just follow up on that. I too am really struck by these numbers. And on the one hand, I feel a sense of relief that my district has much smaller numbers than Senator Monis Anderson's. But, I think that I suspect that if we had done this snapshot 5 years ago or 10 years ago, I would have had more in my district just because of the demographics of what are happening in Portland, where more fragile families are sort of being forced from inner Portland out to, outer Portland and into Gresham. And, I'm wondering, this is a very useful snapshot, but if we were to look at this over time, is this a growing problem? I suspect it is. And I think that's what makes it so important that we start working on this, really seriously, because, where is this problem going to take us over time? So I wonder if you could respond to that, just what sort of long-term trends we're seeing.
Sure. Could I start?
Sure.
Thank you, Chair Dumbrell. One of the big issues is really taking a look at the trauma that these young people have suffered already. So you already know that 4 is the litmus point, 4 out of 10 adverse childhood experiences, for these youth and children to move into the pipeline of chronic illness as young adults. And throughout their lifetimes, which will be shortened, they're also not inclined with these kinds of experiences. They are inclined to take risk behaviors. They're not likely to be able to finish school. We know that about half of the chronic absenteeism come from the unaccompanied minors, which are the half that are not represented in the numbers that the school districts have provided. And so these youth have the possibility of tanking health care reform, tanking 40-40-20, and the other objectives we have for this state. And of course, there is the moral and personal damage, the difficulties in being able to raise good families themselves or to be able to contribute back. And so it has, in the 1-4 number is a number that was actually developed through an external study done by another entity, not inside the alliance, that came up with that number, and that was a few years ago. So you can understand if the juvenile justice numbers are in here and other numbers. So, but the positive on this is that these youth have resiliency, and we know that you can recapture that resiliency, and we know you can build and capitalize on it. And so with interventions and with these kinds of services, we know that we will get a return on the investment in having youth who will be graduating from high school and having personal goals met and be able to raise healthy families of their own.
Yes.
Chair Dumbra and the other members of the committee. I'm trying to answer the question, is the problem getting larger? I don't know. I think it is to a certain degree in terms of numbers. I think it's getting more serious in terms of the young people and their experiences. When we were doing homeless runaway work in Washington County in the 70s, the primary group of young people we were serving were runaways, and it was to keep them out of detention, that they were unaccompanied, they were curfew violators and truants, and we had volunteer foster homes doing it. You know, they were families who would say, "We'll take those kids in for a night or two while you straighten out with whatever crisis is going in their family," and it's kind of stunning how what we would consider how lightweight that is now. You know, those young people are not being addressed at all. No one's picking up truants. No one's seeing curfew violations as something to be addressed. So we're really saying to young people, it's okay for you to skip school, and it's okay for you to not to be out at all hours in the evening, because no one's saying you need to go home or there's no place safe to go. So I think the young people that are now approaching us are in a much more traumatized condition, have been generally on their own longer, months rather than weeks. And some have already been becoming chronically homeless by living in the woods for 2 or 3 years. We've had young people, you know, who have come to us saying, I saw my friend, you know, get hit in the head with a hammer, and he was my partner in the woods, and, you know, and he got so badly beaten, I decided I need to do something different. But he had been living in the woods for 3 years, and he was 14. So I don't know that it's the numbers of, I think we didn't count them before. That's one thing. So we didn't know what the numbers. They were invisible. But I think the things that these young people are facing, the level of self-reliance they have to have. They see themselves as abandoned, and that they've adjusted to that. The other factor that I think is very disturbing is both our public safety system and our child welfare systems have allowed these young people to exit in unhealthy states and not followed up with them. So when young people run away from foster care, I think there'll be some attempt to find them, but eventually they'll close the case. Well, is that young person still dependent? You know, if they happen to run away from foster care at 12 or 13 or 14 and they say, "I don't want to go back," that's just not all right. So I think you've got this accumulation of some very neglected, abused, and hopeless young people. And the other challenge is they will have children. I mean, that's, you know, what we know is that the inevitable reality is that this cycle will continue because they have not, you know, had someone help to understand how do you care for another person over time? How do you not quit on somebody? So I don't hope that answers.
Chair Dumbra, just one other quick little demographic that I mentioned that the Alliance over time has done three different studies, and one of them was on about 1,800 youth who were coming into shelter care, and the fastest growing demographic is that they're multiracial. So these are kids who are challenged with some of the parental issues that we talked about, but they're also challenged with having more than one identity. And so they might be the black kid at school, but they're the Hispanic, Spanish-speaking family at home. And so so their lives are getting more and more complex in that regard, as well as in the regards that Mike was pointing out.
Mm-hmm. And how about sexual identity? Is that also, an issue here?
Yes, it is an issue here, and we have met with that Q Center and have set up the possibility of a partnership where we would be able to actually bring trainings in, because another one of the demographics, thank you for acknowledging it, Chair Dembrow, sexual orientation and those issues, and making sure that the shelters have a training for them, can receive them, and can direct them towards the right kinds of support and services, which are going to be a little bit different.
And just to add, I think that's oftentimes one of those points of conflict about why the family disrupts or the young person leaves or is asked to leave. So I think that can be repaired. I mean, with some good intervention, and we know that that's not forever. Many of those parents and young people wind up reuniting, but it's after 3 or 4 years of the young person being isolated or on the street. So the earlier intervention, the better on that.
Thank you.
And this is intensive. I mean, each child is different.
Oh, yeah.
And their needs are different. So a strategy with them is different for each child. So yeah, there's no one way to address the child. And so and that's the only way we're going to really make a difference, is doing really intensive work, seeing where the child is at and learning what they want and what is going to make them travel down the path that they want to. And they can't really be mainstream because they're going to be lost.
Chair Dumbrow, Senator Mona Sanderson, that is true, but there's also a natural progression. The first thing you have to do is create a sense of safety and a safe place to be. Mm-hmm. It's impossible to go to school, to look for a job, to really think about who you are and what you want to do if you're anxious about where you're going to eat and whether someone's going to attack you. So the first thing is to create some sense of safety and stability. And that can be done in a pretty short period of time, quite frankly. You know, most of our shelter stays are under 90 days. So, and then you can start sorting out, where are the other resources, where's the family, where's the other adults in this person's life, can we get them back in school, you know? And so, but without that, and I think that's the, trying to put a manpower program or you know, a job employment program as a standalone just will never work. So.
Do we have a follow-up? Yes, yes. I'm sorry. Chair. Like the shelters, I mean, for instance, in my area, I can only think of one shelter, but I don't know if there's more. I mean, do we have a list of shelters that youth would actually use?
Chair Dumbrow, Senator Mo Sanderson, there's very few. I mean, really, probably Janus Youth Programs is the area that would serve, you know, Gresham. And I think they're concerned they're not as far east as they'd like to be.
No,
it's mostly geared, that whole system is geared for downtown Portland.
Right.
And that was because of the Business Alliance. They wanted kids off the street. I mean, that's why there's a very, very heavy investment. So I think, but there's the only reason there isn't, there's plenty of desire. New Avenues for Youth would open something in Gresham in a heartbeat, but they're stretched now to do what they're doing, as are all of us. We have a shelter in Hillsborough. Beaverton's desperate for us to do something in Beaverton. We're losing $300,000 a year. You know, and that's including $250,000 of private investment already. So there's a certain point where and the city of Beaverton is saying, we'll put in $20,000. Well, that's good. But that's the whole system is so thin, and it's so unstable. Because now any one of us that has, like in Roseburg, there's been services that have gone up and down because of funding shifts. And they've been members of the Alliance, and they haven't. Because, you know, so statewide, you can see the instability.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, let's just close with a little more information about the advisory committee that's being envisioned here. So, the bill doesn't go into great detail about, you know, who's on it, but just sort of suggests it'll be a mix of providers. And, you know, I'm wondering what it is you're envisioning. I assume you're going to want representation from counties and, you know, local governments, and I mean just the various different silos that are out there to bring them together. So, and I assume a statewide kind of approach to this. So what is it you're thinking of more specifically?
Well, Chair Dimbrough, thank you for the question. We would like to bring the public service entities who should be touching the lives of these children and these youth to be part of the conversation and the planning. So that would include, of course, addictions and mental health and housing and
education.
Education
workforce.
Is a very important one. The workforce, yes. So we wanted to make sure that the advocates are at the table. We would like to get some youngsters to the table. And we'd like to have the service sectors that can impact their lives and see what we can put together that's a coordinated approach that understands the hydraulics and that will beef up the existing system, because we think that foundation is very, very important, and then expand into areas where there are the greatest need, like in East County, for example.
That's great. Yeah, I do think it would be great if you could find some former unaccompanied youth or runaway youth, you know, to be part of this, who can speak from their experience.
Well, I just met with Chair.
Yes.
Met with some foster care kids that have now sort of, they're over 18 now, and they're part of a group.
The Foster Youth Connection.
But some of the stories that they told me also about running away from foster care, not happy, and they have a lot of insight. I mean, the kids, the youth do have insight that they need to be a part of the process.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Chair Dimbrough, members, the good news about a program like Transitional Living is we're involved with these young people for could be 3 years. So there's many of them who are very eager to participate in a more, and they're older adults, or they're older youth, so they're, you know, 18, 19, 20 years old, who are very eager to participate in helping shape what and give information about their experiences.
Great. Okay, well, thank you both of you for coming forward. And, you know, with this bill, we're not going to work it today because Chair Gelser wants to vote on it. And we're going to give her that privilege.
Well, thank you for this opportunity.
Yes. Before I close the public hearing, though, you two can go. Is there anyone else who's here in the audience that would like to speak to this issue of the challenge of runaway youth or unaccompanied youth? Anybody here? Got a room full of REAP students. If any of you would like to come up and speak, I would appreciate it. Come on up.
would love to have you come up to speak with us to just see what you think about what we just were talking about.
They're here for the trauma.
You don't have to lobby us.
Spot,
they're here for the other agenda, I think. Aren't they, Michael?
Yeah, I'm not sure. Actually.
I think they're here for the trauma.
Sure.
Yeah.
So just to start off, if you could introduce yourself.
My name is Colby Ross.
Colby, welcome.
I feel like that's a good idea. There's a lot of, like, foster kids that's like taking advantage of in the system and like overlooked. So, you know, like I feel like that's a good idea for them to have transitional homes and everything. But there is like problems with like I don't know, some kids don't like live well in homes like that, like group homes and stuff. So I feel like there should be more of a demand for like regular just foster homes, you know, because like that's not a good way to live. Like I mean, if it's a last like effort, then that's a good idea, but I feel like there should be more foster homes for kids and like more families that's willing to take them in, because like you guys said in the beginning, like how is a kid supposed to learn how to like interact with other people and like just like look for jobs and everything if he doesn't like if he or she doesn't know how to like I mean doesn't have that family, you know, connection.
Yeah, thank you for that. Yeah, it's a challenge that we've been talking about a lot in this committee and other committees, just the need to get more families to participate in the foster system, you know, good foster parents. I think that's critical to all this. Okay, thank you very much. Thanks for coming forward. Okay, anybody else? Last chance. Okay, with that then, I will close this public hearing on House Bill 2232A. And again, expect it to come up for a vote probably next week. Okay, now I'm going to open our informational meeting on the impact of childhood trauma and discrimination on lifelong health, achievement, and independence. Who do we have to speak to this, Cheyenne?
Mr. Chair, members, Senator Gelser was approached by a representative to set aside the time on the committee's agenda today. Haven't yet received a formal list of folks who were invited to speak. I believe it's an open floor on this topic. Unless they have in mind to make some introductory remarks, we can just go ahead with whoever approaches.
Okay.
Why we have any volunteers.
So was there invited testimony for this?
I never received a confirmed list of invited speakers from the representative's office.
Let's see.
We're just for the topic.
Okay. So is there anyone here, either from REAP or, you know, anyone else, who wants to speak about this issue of how the experience of trauma during childhood, and trauma, you know, can be physical, it can be emotional, it can be psychological, and, you know, being involved in an unstable family or subject to various forms of discrimination in your upbringing can impact you in a lifelong manner. Come on up. All right, that's right. That's great. We have three seats. Okay, these are the courageous trailblazers, but don't feel that we need to end with them. Okay. Why don't we begin over here? If you could introduce yourself.
My name is Daniel Valdovinos, and I'm from Madison High.
Okay. Yeah, so we'll just go one at a time. So, Daniel, talk to us about this.
As a kid, from my personal perspective, I grew up in a household with just my mom and six siblings. And while my mom was working three jobs, I grew up in the environment of all Latinos and Chicanos. And all that was around was just gangsters. And every time I would walk around, there would always be fighting. And then I grew up with that and going to school. And even on my way to school in the mornings, I would fear of getting jumped and getting in fights with others. And then I wouldn't be able to concentrate in school because that would always be going through my head. And even on my ways home, I'd be scared to walk through the alleys.
Thanks. And let me just ask you a follow-up question. And has that changed for you?
Yes, yeah, it's changed over this past 5 months. I've been separating myself from those people, and I've been changing. I've been getting my things together.
Okay, great. Okay, we'll follow up with you. Welcome again, Helen. Yeah. And again, introduce yourself for the record, please.
Once again, I'm Kobe Ross. Much like him, I grew up in a broken family. I was in and out of foster care and everything, like they were just talking about, my family, we grew up without a mother and a father, really, like, so we had to raise each other, and I have, two brothers and one sister, so we, and they're, like, 6 years older than me, so they kind of raised me. it was hard for me growing up because, like, you know, they're in gangs and everything too, so I had to grow up around them, and I kind of, like, you know, I didn't want to be like that. I wanted to be somebody different, but because of the way that they grew up, they forced me to be the way that they are. So, like, it's kind of hard, and it is traumatizing, like, just not feeling like you're the same as your brothers and sisters, like, or your mom and your dad. So it's like, yeah, there's not a lot you could do to really, I don't know, but I changed too. Like, I start going to school more and start doing what I needed to do, and I broke apart, and, like, really growing up, I found who I am, so I'm not really ashamed. So, you know, I've really just been, once I found myself, I really just, like, changed my life around.
That's great. Thank you, Colby.
My name is Abel Salazar. I'm from Madison High School. Me, from my personal background, I came from two parents. They were divorced. And as I got older, I got kicked out of the house when I was, like, age 13. And ever since then, I just been growing up rough. Like, my parents, like, they always taught me to, like, they always threw responsibility and, like, the real world at me right away, you know what I mean? So I had to deal with it at a young age, so it impacted me a lot. And I've been moving around since I was, like, young. Like, I've been to hundreds of different elementaries, hundreds of middle schools, hundreds of high schools, like, a bunch. And, like, moving around till, like, right now, like, as 11th grader in Madison High School, I've lost credits because of them. But they I don't even live with them no more. I don't live with my mom or dad. I live with my brother. He's about 19 years old. He raises me, so he has a person. He went through the same thing I went through because my parents did the same thing to him. So right now, like, them, like, he, what he's learned from them, like, their, like, his rough past, he's raising me as a young man, you know what I mean, to be responsible, to get your act together, and don't be out in the streets messing around, you know what I mean? And so, like, I think it would be a great impact because, like, on my future, because I don't want to be falling behind on things because I blame them. Like, oh, you did it, it's all your fault, the reason why I'm failing in school. I can say that all I want, but what am I really going to do? Am I really going to change what's going to happen right here, right now? Or am I going to cry about it? So that's what I've been doing from here now on.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, all three of you. So let me ask you what... they're not done yet. let me ask you... so you're all, you know, on a much better path right now.
Yeah.
But do you still feel pressure to kind of go back to the way it was before? Or, you know, what are the risks, you know, that you face that you need to overcome?
We just got to face the bad habits because that's what we grew up with and that's what we've always known. So it's hard to change because you can't just change in a day. It all takes time. And sometimes it's hard because those people that you used to know, you see them and you bump into them once in a while. And they always want to hang out and stuff. And it's hard to reject them because those are the people you grew up with. You've been kicked out and nobody else was there but them to help you out.
Yeah, and you don't want to reject them either.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Some of those people, like he's saying, some of those people you see as family, and, like, when you start to change your life for the better, they see you as trying to be better than them, and it's, like, it's hard to change yourself and not be able to bring somebody with you. So, like, it just, like, sometimes you just want to just be, like, you know, screw it and just go back to what you used to do and be with them. It's affected me more in school than anything because, like, last year I had to, like, I couldn't go to school for half of the year because I was busy, like, taking care of my family and everything and, like, you know, raising myself, basically. So, and I used to skip a lot and just, I had really bad habits. So now that I'm trying to change, like, the school, they're, like, they put a lot of pressure on me and, like, they kind of lock me down and they don't trust me. So, like, and they threaten me, like, to expel me and everything, like, every move I make. So I feel like I'm kind of, like I can't breathe in my classrooms. So, like, sometimes I'm just, like, I just feel like, you know, I'm going to just do what I want to do. But then I remember, like, I have to change, because the way that I was going, it wasn't going to go well.
Great. Abel?
I could say, like, the way that my past growing up, because I just barely moved down here from San Diego. And so it was really, really rough down there. And going, like, seeing the same, like, comparison from here, from San Diego to Oregon, there's always places that are ghetto out here or have them struggles out here. But it's on you. It's on you to make a change. You know what I mean? It's like, I don't feel pressured. Like, I've known, like, my brother told me, my dad told me, my mom told me, don't ever feel peer pressured. If you want to do it, it's on you. Don't feel peer pressured. Like, don't make decisions off of other people. You know what I mean? So me as a person now, I make decisions off of me, my choice, not off of other people. So, like, from going back, like, to back where I used to live, it was just like, I know it wasn't meant for me, because I know I got better things to do than be kicking it on the block. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I decided. You know.
So you've all chosen to be part of this REAP program. I mean, how is that part of your sort of taking control of your life?
How is it what?
How is it part of your taking control of your life? What is that? How does that help you to, to stay on the right path? Let's put it that way.
It helps us because when we're in school, we have people to talk with that can help us. Like, if we're not having a good day and we still got to go to our classes, I mean, they can help us out with our work so we won't put a lot of weight on our shoulders and they can take some weight. And it's been helping me a lot because I've been coming to the field trips and then learning how to speak and how to change my act and how to learn how to get along with others and get my communication skills together.
It's helped me a lot just in, like, everything, really. Like, it's good to have a person that you look up to, like people like Brian and Mr. Jackson. You'll meet them later, most likely. And, you know, when I look at them and I see them up here speaking and stuff, like, with power in their voices and everything, it really motivates me to be, like, somebody. Like, I really want to be like them one day. And, you know, just them being African-American, too, like, you know, our, like, the chances of us, like, the school-to-prison pipeline and everything, like, all of that, it's just, like, there's not a lot of hope. So just seeing a black man give you hope, like, that's good enough for in itself.
Yeah. Abel?
I say as, like, this is my first time going here, my first field trip. I got invited, so I was, like, really new to, like, stuff like this because I never went on field trips related to this political stuff that they talk about. And it's just something brand new. So, like, when I've sat down in the first room we were in, it was kind of interesting to get to know, like, a lot of the stuff that they were talking about. And it just caught my attention. So I feel like if I keep doing this and keep going on the field trips, it could benefit me in the future. So that's why.
Great. Yes, Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. To you and anybody else that this applies to, something I don't talk about a lot. I'm a recovering addict. Okay, I was running for a lot of years. And you're on the right path, and you're right. It's on you. But you can make it. And I just want to let you know, I'm an example of the fact that there is life on the other side. So hang in there and keep doing what you're doing. Life can be good.
Thank you.
Thanks, Senator. Okay, thank you, all three of you, for coming and sharing.
Are there any females? Can you answer?
I think it's time for us to hear from some women. Huh? Who wants to come up and talk to us and give us the experience from a woman's point of view? Okay. No, it's fine. Yeah.
Why not?
Okay, great.
Uh-oh. Down, give me that.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much for coming forward.
Okay. So.
Okay.
Hi, my name is Dowie Gamachu-Sato, and I'm a junior at David Douglas High School. You know, introduce yourself? No.
Just
me? Okay. So I'm talking about some stuff that's just as important, but not directly at me, but towards everybody. I attend David Douglas High School, and it's a school that preaches diversity yet fails to show it. We attend a school that is one of the biggest in Oregon, yet there are no teachers that look like me. There are no women of color in my school, which teaches me that, you know, I might not be able to make it if I decide to go as a teacher, you know. There's clubs like BSU, Latina Club, you know, there's clubs to, like, separate us, but there's no club besides REAP that joins us all together. There's, in one classroom at David Douglas, there's about 30 students inside of there. And yeah, there is some diversity amongst the students, but there's not much diversity amongst the teachers. And it's really hard in a room full of 30 plus students to find individual time with my teachers, whether it's English, whether it's college US history, regardless of whatever the class it is, it's hard to find one-on-one time with my teacher and say, hey, I didn't understand that slide, I didn't know what you were saying. And David Douglas is trying to fix this by creating Scott Center, which is a place we can go and get tutoring and all this. But it's hard for students that have other extracurricular activities happening outside of school, having to pick up a sibling, having to, you know, put food on the plate for their family, regardless of whatever it is. It's hard to do those things and stay after school for Scott Center. It's hard to manage all those things at one time. I wanted to talk to you guys also about Smarter Balance, how it's going on. And we had a senator, I think, come in and talk to us about Smarter Balance and how we can opt out of it. It just kind of frustrates me how I feel like it's leaning against me because all the questions on there, it's just like, whoa, we haven't really learned this stuff, you know? When I took the math Smarter Balance test, it's like, wow, I can't use a calculator. Like, come on, like, what? Sorry. I had to just throw that in. I was like, what? It's a math test. I can't use a calculator, you know? I'm not the smartest person out there. So, yeah, I just feel like it's weighed against me and my peers, you know? Not everyone's that smart to know every single math equation. I'm not a calculator. And attendance rates at David Douglas, they've been starting to, like, print out, like, hey, you have 80% attendance, good job, or you have 60% attendance, whatever it is. And it's just that they're so quick to say, oh, you haven't been showing up to school, which is good. When you look at it from one point of view. But it's just like I have so many peers and so many classmates that are dealing with problems at home. There's friends that don't have food on the plate. There are friends that don't have electricity at home. If it gets me mad that every single thing that we have at school requires an internet access. Like, if I need to do my marine science homework, it's like, oh, well, you weren't here, you can go on the computer at home. But not everyone at school has internet access. Not everyone, and even if they don't have internet access, not everyone has the pride to say, oh yeah, you know me, I don't have internet access at home, so you know. And like I said earlier, not everyone has that time to come after school because they have other things going on as well. And it's nice that you guys are funding our school and funding the curriculum, but at the same time, it's just like we have iPads, we have laptops, we have all these computers and stuff, but we can't even use them when we really need them for homework and such. We can't take them home. We only get to use them at school. And even the time we are using it at school, we have to share it with 30 other students. And yeah. That's just really some of the things. There are students that are being bullied and all these things, and it's just frustrating that the teachers are so quick to be like, you're not showing up to school, you know? Yeah, that's a problem, but you're not really taking the time to ask me what's going on. You know, somebody could have died. Something could have happened at home, you know? That's my, my spiel. Yeah.
Okay. No, thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you for listening.
And we'll have questions also.
Hello. I'm Rashard Clay, and I go to David Douglas, and I'm a junior. I kind of want to touch up on when Dowie was talking about like not getting the help you need. I'm currently living out of district, and sometimes I feel like I have to lie just to not like to avoid getting in trouble all the time for simple things like recently my aunt passed away, and I didn't want to go to school, and I tried to explain that to them, and they kind of, like, didn't care. Like, they're just like, oh, okay. And they still tried to put me in lunch detention and stuff for being, for missing school or being late. So I feel like I have to lie, like, oh, I had a doctor's appointment or a dentist appointment, like. And I hate that they have, like, a certain day where certain excuses are valid. Like, oh, that excuse isn't valid today. Like, it's the truth. Like, am I supposed to lie to you to show up to school? I just feel like that's not fair. And I want to talk about our boundary lines. Like, you can live on 143rd in Burnside and be 2 minutes away from your school, but be in the Park Rose District. I don't like that at all. That is not the coolest thing ever. But I just don't like that. It irritates me as a student. It does. As a student, and
yeah, it seems really arbitrary, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And like the whole not living in the district, like they use that against you if you like be honest with them and let them know instead of trying to like go behind the district and use like false addresses and all that. If you be honest with them, they use it against you. Like, say you're not doing too well in school, they threaten you, oh, we're going to kick you out. You don't belong in our district anyway. Like, if your grade goes a little too low or... But you could be the student who tries, but you just don't get around to it because you have problems at home. Like she said, like, I have problems at home all the time, and some days I just don't want to come to school or I won't make it to school on time. And I feel like I have to sit in ISS all day if I miss a lunch detention or something. And I don't like that, like... they're pulling us out of class for missing class. Like, you get lunch detention for being late, and then they give you that lunch detention, and then you skip it or something, or you just didn't make it because you went to go work on something, and the teacher didn't let them know that, and they put you in ISS all day. Like, that doesn't make sense to me. Pull me out of class for no reason. Like, I don't know. It's just a lot of problems, but... We do also have good things about our school, though. I like our school.
That's
okay. Oh, go ahead.
Okay. And I'll come back to some questions for you, Rashard. Let's move on.
My name is Jessica Munha Perez. I'm a sophomore at David Douglas. And it's kind of related to them, but it's not. As a Latina, I went to a leadership conference, and I learned that 9% of low-income students go to college, and that really shocked me. And then I started thinking about it, and I remember, like, when I was young, I would always hear adults talking, and what impacted me was, like, they would just be talking about how they expect, like, they didn't expect it, but it wasn't a shock if a Latina got pregnant. And so, I know growing up, that impacted me. I was like, I don't want to be one of those people. And so that's actually made me work hard in school. And being in the leadership program actually helped me more because I'm actually able to come up here and talk to you guys. I'm still kind of nervous. But I wouldn't have been able to do that before. And I've been able to talk more to people, do stuff I usually wouldn't do. But... I think the program is great, and if I wouldn't been in the program, I don't know what I would be doing right now. I come from a family where only two people went to college and graduated, and all the other people dropped out of high school or finished high school but decided to not go to college because they didn't think it was important. But I know I want to go to college, and I'm doing the best I can, so I'm afraid I'm not going to make it. But I know I have the support that they believe in me. So I go home and I actually do have my parents' support. But sometimes when you go to school, you don't have the support you're looking for. And so a lot of people look for the support outside of school. And that's when they go to gangs or they go and hang out with people that support them, but not necessarily in the right direction. And so the REAP program is such a great program because they're supporting you, but also in the direction that people should be heading to.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I just want to comment on the problem that you started off with, Daria, about there not being as many teachers of color as we would like. That is a big challenge, and you know, I guess I would throw out to everyone here to consider going into teaching, you know, as a career, because that is it is a big problem. I know at the college where I teach, we have a program, a great program actually. It's called the Portland Teachers Program, and it takes students who start at the community college. They do 2 years there, then they go to Portland State for a bachelor's degree and then a master's degree, and then go to work in one of the local school districts. There's a, you know, it's kind of a cohort group, sort of like REAP, where students are supporting other students and a lot of outside support. And it's been really a remarkable program. But, you know, it's limited. And, you know, I think there are maybe 20 to 30 students who go through that program each year. But the need is huge. So I would just encourage everybody here to consider going into teaching. I'm being selfish about this, but there's no job, including being a legislator, that's more important, you know, where the need is greater, where you can really make a difference in people's lives. That was not a question. That was that was a sermon. Yeah.
So my older brother, he's one of the people in my family that went to college, and I think he's the only Latino teacher that I've known of besides Spanish teachers. He teaches history, and he talks about his students, and all I hear is that great connection he has because of his background, because he used to go on the wrong... He wasn't the best student, but his junior year, he decided to become a teacher, and they told him, if you want to be a teacher, you can't be doing what you're doing now. So he started to change, and so I'm really proud of him because he's a teacher. But I know a lot of students that were thinking about being teachers, but a lot of teachers are being laid off or they're just not being hired. So they just have the mentality of if they go into the teacher, like if they want to be a teacher, there's less space for them because there's a lot of teachers. And so it's discouraging them to go that way. So they're trying to look for like the STEM that actually pays better. But, yeah, that's what I think on the topic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, Senator Mona Sanderson.
Well, he's a teacher. I'm a nurse. And so I want you to know that at least in many of the community colleges that have nursing programs, we want to have people of color. Because when you're in the healthcare industry and giving care to patients, many patients respond better to people of their own kind, so to speak. There are many opportunities in the healthcare industry now. That's where the money is for some reason. But don't forget healthcare also. Sorry, Mr. Chair, but I had to put a plug in for that.
Okay, Senator Cruz, you want to convince them to become farmers?
I'm not sure there's a whole lot of opportunities to become a farmer in the Portland area. But
thank you. Yes, Daria. Sure.
My sister's a nurse, and my older brother is going in to be a doctor. You know, the whole squad is going into medical.
That's
school.
Great.
But like, I'm in a program called Trio Upper Bound, and they're really like interested in having more students be involved in it because it's college readiness. We visit colleges. You know, there's just a lack of funding in our school to Upper Bound, so a lot of students can't really be involved in it. So a lot of students aren't hearing about the in-state school options that they have. You know, besides the 5 minutes they get with their counselors and such. Just I might.
No, that's yeah. Very fair. Part of the problem that we have is, you know, state resources are limited, but so are federal now. We used to, you know, Upward Bound was a federal program, I think, and, you know, a lot of the programs to help create pathways for young people were funded through the federal government, and those dollars are drying up. And so we're trying to be more and more creative in terms of getting private sponsors, you know, individuals or corporations, you know, to help partner with the state to create these kinds of opportunities. Because, you know, it really is important to put people on pathways where they know if they stay on track, if they work hard, it's going to pay off.
Thank you.
Okay, thank all three of you for coming up. Okay. Hey, do we have any other reapers?
Hi.
Hi.
My name is Taya Hillman Johnson. We're all from Parkrose High School. You guys want to introduce your names?
Sure. I'm Kai Pfizer, Parkrose High School.
I'm Harvey Nguyen.
We kind of have one speech thing for all three of us. So in recent years, we've all heard about the recent budget cuts in the arts programs, and our personal experience with it at Park Rose includes cutting all of the art classes at the middle school. Now, there are still choir and band classes there, but our middle school doesn't have a theater program. And as most people may know, the earlier you are introduced to a subject, the more likely you are to pursue it in the future. And I don't know if any of you are aware, but actually in Salem, this is kind of where we hold our theater state festival, and we were here like 2 weeks ago or something.
Yeah,
and
it's awesome.
Like, there were a lot of us. We were all at the Elsinore in the Salem Convention Center. Mm. And pretty much all the schools that can afford to go, we all come here and we do workshops. And for theater kids pretty much all around Oregon, it's like state is an event that everybody looks forward to. And it's a family reunion for actors and techies and just everybody who loves this art form. And you always meet someone new. However, at Park Rose, there's another event that we're all kind of looking forward to. So in December, our theater program was nominated to go to this theater festival called the Fringe Festival. And it's like the biggest theater event like in the world. And 2 weeks ago, we learned that we were actually accepted. So 1,000 schools over the country, like throughout the country, are nominated to go to it. And then you put in your application and 40 are chosen. So we were one of the 40 chosen. And the Fringe Festival, pretty much we're there for 2 nights in London, and then we're in Scotland for 2 weeks performing 6 shows just around Scotland. And pretty much it's like the experience of a lifetime.
Yeah, over 1 million people visit there over the course of the 3 weeks.
Oh, introduce crazy. Yourself. For the
oh, sorry.
He did.
Oh, yeah, Kai Pfizer.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay.
So like the cost for airfare and food and venue space and all the other necessities, pretty much everything is in one fee, except like if you want to buy your own souvenirs, and it's like about $7,000 a student. So to keep the price at $6,000 to $7,000, we have to take a minimum of 15 to 20 people. And because group prices cost less because the venue space is split between everybody, that's why we want to take about 15 to 20. So we need funding and we need fundraising ideas. And we want to know where in the budget we might be able to get some money or some support even. Like, how can we get what we need? How can we get ideas? How can we even get donations or money, or who can we talk to? And so, yes, we always need ideas, but we need more location than we need directions, if that metaphor kind of thing makes sense. This kind of like an opportunity isn't going to happen for us again. It's pretty much a chance for us to do something incredible, and it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. It's a chance for us to see what it's like there in the world trying to do something impossible, especially in a world where the art of theater is being cut. Specifically in our theater, where the only reason we're still around is because we are self-sufficient. Our school doesn't actually fund us, and all of our money that we have is from ticket sales that we have made through shows. Our school has cut teachers and classes and extracurricular activities, and teachers have to pay for their supplies out of their own pockets due to the stricken amount of poverty at our schools. And you've heard about schools not having enough copy paper for printers to make it through the rest of the year. And REAP is one of the reasons why we believe we can do this. They have given us several opportunities to speak and gather info about how we can go on this trip of a lifetime. They help us not only push ourselves to reach our goal, but also empower us. This opportunity to be around people who share such common interests and are so dedicated that they flew thousands of miles across the world, pretty much, is a chance to do something we all love and also connect with the people from all around the world who go to this festival. Thank you.
Thank you. Harvey, anything you want to add? Was it Harvey?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Theater is awesome.
That's true. I can vouch for it.
Yeah.
But also, a little while ago, we did Beauty and the Beast. And again, to the self-sufficient, I believe that we broke even on that show. So everything that we spent on that, we got back, and we can't really do anything for next year's show, or we can't really go any further. It's very limited in what we can do and what we will do in the future.
Yeah, it's interesting because that was one of our most popular shows we've ever done at the high school, and it would like broke like full house, like every
seat
being filled.
We have about 600 seats, yeah.
600 seats for a few nights, and then we still don't get funding for it, which is interesting, but yeah.
Yeah, it's a real, you know, one of the real challenges that we have in our schools is the lack of funding for the arts, but also for extracurricular activities. You know, when I was going to school, programs like band or, you know, or choir or theater were, you know, or athletics, actually, you know, students didn't have to pay to be part of those programs. It was part of the curriculum, and it was supported by the school. But today, it really is striking, and it's depressing. I was just at David Douglas a couple of months ago, and I mean, they have an outstanding band program there, but it's all self-support, and you have families that are really low income, and so how do you get kids to be able to be part of those programs, which for many of them, it's a key part of why they go to school. It really adds richness to their experience there, and even more so for some, it's really, really important. So that's a challenge that we have, because we're having, you know, just as a state, we're having real challenges just funding the basics right now. I can tell you it's something that we're thinking about all the time. You know, I think in the case of Park Rose, you know, I think it's going to be important for you also to look to the Park Rose community, because, you know, the fact that your group has been invited to the Edinburgh Theater Festival, I mean, I know about that festival. It's incredibly important. It's, you know, as you say, the top arts festival in the world. I mean, that's remarkable, and you guys should feel so good about yourselves. But so Park Rose should feel really good about itself. And, you know, I look forward to helping you, you know, with that. I don't know how much I can help, but, you know, I'll try to. Anything else? Okay, thank you, all three of you.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
Anybody else? Okay. Come on up. Thank you very much. This is what leadership is all about, stepping up.
So, hi, my name is Diana Utter. I'm 14 years old. I'm from Harrison Park.
My name is Elizabeth, and I'm also from Harrison Park.
Okay. Elizabeth, what's your last name?
Silva.
Welcome.
And I'm here to talk mainly about the lack of resources. One main one that sticks out to me the most is the lack of, is the teachers. The teachers at, like, our schools, like, we need teachers that care and not teachers who just go, oh, yeah, do whatever, I'm getting paid anyway, you know, like, we need teachers who can help us, because that's their job, to teach us and to be able to, like, be there when we need that support. Like, for example, like, if, like, I don't get an assignment and I go to my teacher, he or she just goes, oh, yeah, go ask your classmates and see if they know. And I'm just there standing there like, I came to you because nobody else gets it, because, like, you know, they're just rushing through their lessons. They're not explaining it well like they should. Yeah. And that's just what I think is lacking so far.
Do you have any thoughts about why your teachers might feel kind of burned out or whatever?
Maybe it's like the bad kids or something, you know, because there are a lot of bad kids and there are a lot of people around us who are mainly disrespectful and don't listen to the teachers. And I feel like the teachers just go, okay, so you don't want to learn that, then I'll be this way if you're going to be like that. So.
Okay, thanks. Great. Elizabeth? Talk to us.
Okay. I think some of the reason why they don't help us that much is because they have a lot of students every day. Well, some teachers have a lot of students every day, and so they just think that every student doesn't care about what they're learning or what's being taught to them. So that's why maybe they don't really want to hear our opinion about what we want to learn next and what we really need help on. Mm-hmm. Because sometimes I struggle and I ask for help, but then they don't really like tell me like what I'm looking for, like what I struggle on. They just like see the overall thing that they said before that I didn't get. So it's barely any help.
Anything else you want to talk to us about, aside from the challenges with your teachers?
Well, this was actually my first year at Harrison Park. I came from the Reynolds District, which I would say doesn't need as much financial aid as Harrison Park. I mean, they don't have like really good materials and equipments that can help them learn. They just have like outdated laptops, not like Reynolds, where they have like updated laptops or computers and iPads that they're able to give to their students for them to like use and everything. And also financial aid towards sports. They don't have as many activities as Reynolds did. They don't have as many like elective like classes, like they don't have band or orchestra, theater or choir. Yeah, and I just feel like Harrison Park needs that because, you know, kids have to get involved in everything. They can't just have several choices. They need to have a lot, like a variety of choices. So yeah.
Mm-hmm. Anything else you want to talk about?
No.
Okay. Colleagues, any questions for this panel?
Just thank you so much for coming up. You know that in the legislature, only about 25% of the legislators are women. So that's why I really wanted to have some of you women come up and speak. Thank you.
Yeah. But let me say they are very capable women, those 25%. Anyone else?
I think they
want to
go home. I think they're
good. Yeah? Come on up. All right, time for the wrap up.
There you go.
Welcome.
Mark Jackson, Reed Program. Thank you, Chair Dembro and committee members. Thank you for this informational hearing with our students. I want to underscore the value of student voice. So thank you for taking the time to affirm their leadership and their potential, and we hope in the future we can come again and have more dialogue with our students. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Mark. Let me just say before you leave, one last thing, and that is, you know, in the session before this hearing, you know, you asked me what, you know, how you can get involved, how you can make a difference, and you know, let me say that coming here before us and sitting down, and you are now part of the official record of this legislature. Your testimony is recorded in audio and video form. You can go back and watch yourselves after the fact. You know, it's something that we will all learn from, and it will make a difference, I promise you. So thank you for stepping up and being leaders and being involved in this program.
Well, not only were you recorded and you can go back and watch it, it's now part of the official history of the state of Oregon and will be preserved forever.
That's correct.
Is it on YouTube or...
We have an archives building where all of this stuff ends up. I don't know how they do it. It's high-tech stuff, and I'm old. So
yeah. it's on the legislative website, and anyone can take it and convert it onto YouTube, where I'm sure it's going to go viral. So it's a good idea. Okay, so with that, I'm going to close our informational hearing. And colleagues and members of the audience, we are adjourned for the day.
Thank you.
Adjourned for the day.
Thank you.